From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the spirit realm. Here's what's happening. Planet Earth could be the higher risk area of a space rock impact than widely thought. Boy, that's not good news. According to astronomers who suggested keeping a closer eye now on distant giant comets, most studies of potential Earth smashers focuses on objects on the asteroid belt, roughly between Mars, Earth's outside neighbor, and Jupiter out there on its other flank. But they noted that the discovery in the last two decades of hundreds of giant comets, dubbed centaurs, with much larger orbits, requires expanding the list of potential hazards. Just what we need, huh? And as we reported yesterday, SpaceX sent a Falcon rocket soaring toward orbit Monday night with 11 small satellites. It's the first mission since an accident last summer. Then, in an even more amazing feat, it landed the 15-story leftover booster back on Earth safely. Our science advisor and space historian, Robert Zimmerman, more good news in space there, Robert. I like it.
Oh, this is spectacular, George. In fact, this is a game changer. This changes the whole industry and the whole future of space. This is a very historic event because what this does is it's going to cut the cost of launch significantly. It's going to mean that more companies, more people, more entrepreneurs can afford to get their payloads into orbit, people into orbit. It means we have capabilities now we've never had before. It's also science fiction. I mean, you know, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, it was assumed everything would land vertically by rockets, and then they discovered, no, that's not cost-effective. It's impossible. Well, Elon Musk and SpaceX has proved, no, it isn't impossible. The impossible, when it's impossible, it's only a little bit more difficult, as Arthur Clarke once said. It's just a great, great moment, and it's spectacular to watch. The video is just amazing.
It's going to open up all kinds of avenues, isn't it?
Yes, well, what will happen now is it also forces every other rocket company to become innovative, to compete. And that means that not just SpaceX, but other companies like Blue Origin and ULA and the Russians and the Chinese and the Europeans have got to come up with better ways to get their rockets into orbit cheaper. They've got to invent new ways to save money. And that means everybody is going to benefit. The human race is going to the stars based on this. This is really a significant moment, and it'll be remembered by future generations. It's a significant moment.
Great. Thanks, Robert. I think the next 10 years going into space is going to be absolutely amazing. As I speak, Iraqi government forces are advancing into the center of the city of Ramadi, which is controlled by the jihadist group Islamic State. Security sources say the troops and allied tribesmen, backed by airstrikes, had already retaken two districts and entered two others. Well, it's about time the Iraqi troops started doing something. According to a report in the Washington Post, Virginia Attorney General Mark Herring will unilaterally end the state's long-held concealed carry reciprocity agreements with 25 other states. Now, if you're a concealed weapons holder in one state, this is what they used to have in a number of other states. And they still do, except Virginia is getting out of that, where you had reciprocity. You didn't have to have a concealed weapons permit in Virginia if you had one in Michigan. You were able to use your gun there, too. Virginia is getting out of that. A Minneapolis man killed his 89-year-old mother after finding bed bugs in the apartment that the two shared. Jeez. The homeless woman accused of intentionally driving her car into a crowd of pedestrians along the Las Vegas Strip Sunday night told police that she was tired, stressed out, but did not clarify her motive further. Lakeisha Holloway, 24 years old, told the investigators that she had tried to park her car in various garages around the city in an effort to get some sleep, but had been made to leave by security guards. Holloway, an Oregon resident, had been in Las Vegas for about a week before she drove her 1996 Oldsmobile sedan onto the sidewalk outside of the Paris and Planet Hollywood casino hotels, killing an Arizona woman, injuring 37 others. As I reported yesterday, the number one used app in 2015 was Facebook. Checking in is Lauren Weinstein, of course, head of the Internet Services and Vortex.com. This is an amazing feat, but I kind of figured Facebook would get the number one ranking, Lauren.
Yeah, It's not a big surprise. Hey, I want to take this opportunity to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
Best wishes for the holidays and to all the listeners and the entire Coast gang. It's been quite a year so far.
It sure has.
Facebook's app is a very kind of strange creature, and you have to understand what Facebook's motives are here. They want you to stay inside Facebook. They want you in that app. They want you to view videos there. They want you to get your news there. They want you to chat there. They want you to listen to the radio there. Everything that you can do inside Facebook, they want you to stay inside Facebook. In some parts of the world where Facebook actually provides free mobile data to people, they don't even realize, a lot of people who use Facebook, that that's not the entire internet. So the reason that this app has become so popular in so many ways is they have built so much stuff into it to try to keep people inside the Facebook ecosystem that it's become sort of the go-to place for people that use Facebook. Now, if you don't like Facebook, if you don't like their privacy policies, which I don't, if you have other problems with them, then that doesn't mean anything to you. You're not going to use the Facebook app. But my recommendation is, even if you use Facebook, and even if you use the Facebook app, get outside of Facebook. Try other things, because there's a big internet out there beyond Facebook.
Apps, by the way, have surpassed your laptop and desktop computers in terms of getting onto websites, hasn't it?
It's a battle. It's not quite clear where it's going to come out. You have web-based services and you have apps, and they each have pluses and minuses from the standpoint of users and from the standpoints of the service providers and the people that are putting out the apps. There's a strange kind of dichotomy that goes on, because from a monetary standpoint, an app takes a tremendous amount of work. In normal circumstances, a good app, a complicated app, to engineer it and to deploy it and to maintain it. A lot more work than it takes in a lot of circumstances to do it through a web interface, where you don't have to deal with each individual app separately. I'm simplifying this in a horrible way, but there are different issues involved and different balances. So it's hard to say right now. I would suggest whether apps or web-based services, or some strange hybrid of the two that's kind of hard to picture right now, will ultimately be the most popular way to access the internet. It's going to be quite a ride.
All right, Lauren, thank you so much. And again, a Merry Christmas to you too, my friend. China, of course, owns trillions of dollars of our debt. They've been going into space. They're working on all kinds of technology. But what's going to happen in the future as they get more technologically advanced? Up next, David Poyer joins us. Tipping Point, the war with China, the first salvo. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. David Poyer graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, later received a master's degree from George Washington University. His active and reserve naval service included sea duty across the planet and shore duty at the Pentagon, Surface Warfare Development Group, Joint Forces Command, and in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. Poyer began writing in 1976 as the author of, more than 40 books. Poyer has taught or lectured at Annapolis, the University of Pittsburgh, the Armed Forces Staff College, and many other prestigious institutions. He began writing back in 76 and is the author, again, as I mentioned, of a book called Tipping Point, The War with China, the First Salvo, which we're talking about tonight. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, George. Great to be here. Been looking forward to it.
And from another Navy guy, good to talk with you. I spent 9 years with the Navy and got out. One more year, I would have been a lieutenant commander, David.
Well, thank you for your service.
Yeah, you too. You too. I was at the Pentagon, not when you were, but were you at Desert Storm when you were in Saudi Arabia?
That was afterward, actually.
Okay.
I was doing research during Desert Storm. I was actually doing scenarios for gas attacks. Actually, I was in the Pentagon then, yes.
Oh, my gosh. You know, my unit got called up to Desert Storm And I had retired 1 month prior to that.
Oh, well, good timing, huh?
They all went up there, and we were public affairs officers, so we worked with Schwarzkopf, and, you know, we were right there, and they all came back with ribbons and everything else.
Oh, you know Eric Berryman, perhaps?
I do not know Eric.
Okay.
But one of my dear friends, Nathan Jones, ended up being an admiral. And,
cool.
He just went all the way. But anyways, it's good to talk with you. And this is
have shipmates in common, George.
I'm sure. Sure we do, out there somewhere, David. This is a novel, but it's based on a lot of fact and a lot of possibilities, isn't it?
Well, I've been doing a lot of research on this over the last 15 books, which are the military books. Did hundreds of interviews, did thousands of hours of research. I have to emphasize, though, that I had no access to compartmented information. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I had to preserve my freedom to write, and I have to point out I have never actually seen the war plans for our action against China. They exist, but I have never laid eyes on them. So I'm free to speculate on future scenarios.
And I'm sure we've got war plans with just about every major nation, don't we?
Well, that's kind of the business. I mean, if we didn't have plans to defend ourselves, we wouldn't be doing our job, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
And most war plans start with that, defense, and then war termination. So I'm sure that there are people who are more in the know than I am, but if they're much more in the know, then they can't talk about it. And I'm sure you know what happened to Captain James Fennell when he spoke out about China's readiness for war against Japan, and that kind of sent a message to everybody on active duty. I think he was removed and reassigned after his comments on China.
I keep thinking, David, that China has its eyes on Taiwan,
and China has had its eye on Taiwan for many, many years, George.
Would we actually go to war in defense of Taiwan, even though we're supposed to? If China decided they're going to go in and take it?
Well, I mean, that's kind of the question, isn't it? And we've always preserved a kind of position that we are friends of Taiwan. In fact, I think there's something in our treaty that says something like that, that we support the independence and freedom and friendship of Taiwan. But we have never actually committed ourselves to its military defense in so many words. So that's kind of been left out there. And that's kind of meant as a deterrent. So what would actually happen is you'd have to have a force authorization, and that's one of the things that takes place in the book. There's this lengthy debate over whether we commit forces in defense of Taiwan.
Let's talk about Tipping Point. Tell us a little bit about the highlights first, and then we'll get into it.
Well, we begin with this is actually a follow-on to the cruiser where Dan Lenson took command of his ship. He found it high and dry in Naples Harbor. The former CO had taken the ship into Naples, and there was a sandbar there that everybody knew was there, and the ship ends up high and dry on the sandbar. I mean, it's obviously buoyed. It's on the charts. Everybody knows it, yet there's the ship. Well, the CO is relieved. Dan is sent in to take over and heal the ship, which obviously has deep problems, not just the CO. The problems run throughout the crew. Well, after the cruiser, he has to defend his record because what he did there has to be defended before Congress. In the beginning of Tipping Point, he has to go home, defend his record, and then return to the ship. And then in the Indian Ocean, Savo Island cruises off East Africa. Her mission is to protect shipping lanes from pirates. But that is kind of a routine patrol, and then an unknown assailant starts assaulting the female crew members. So we start pulling things directly off what actually happens on active duty. And at the same time, a showdown starts between India and Pakistan. Now, Savo Island has kind of a unique capability. She's the first ship that has the ability to shoot down ballistic missiles in flight. And this is a new capability for the surface Navy, as you know, probably. So as the first theater nuclear war begins in the Indian Ocean, Savo Island is the only ship that stands between the two nations. That's how the thing begins.
Now, as you were writing the novel, and I'm not going to give away the ending.
I'm writing away. Yeah, got it.
But as you're putting this together, based on events in your mind, but you're looking at the possibilities of real things happening now, aren't you?
Well, I'm looking at things like the results of war games between India and Pakistan. I studied their mobilization exercises, and I had to decide what would happen in the event of a war between India and Pakistan that began with something like a terrorist attack in Mumbai. It begins with an Islamist terrorist attack. Pakistan and India go to war. It begins with a conventional war. And India, I think, would win such a conventional war. But Pakistan now has a nuclear deterrent. Is Pakistan going to accept losses of a conventional war to India? I think not. So we're looking at the first theater nuclear war, which I think, George, is probably likely within the next 10 to 20 years. I really think we're going to see another a second use of nuclear weapons, ours being the first, of course, in Japan.
This possibility, then, between Pakistan and India, how does that pull us and China into it?
Well, remember how World War One opened, right?
Yeah, a long time ago.
A long time ago, but it opened with two alliances that had armed against each other for quite a while and that were posturing against each other. And then this little incident occurs way off in the periphery in the Balkans. And two of the allies began warning each other. They began pre-mobilization. They began threats. And the other allies have to move in behind them because they're dragged in by treaty commitments and commitments of saving face. So one by one, the allies are dragged into this increasing maelstrom or whirlpool of the war. So I think that's what could happen. It starts with a regional war between India and Pakistan, but people get dragged into it. Iran gets dragged in. Japan gets dragged in. The United States gets dragged in. Taiwan gets dragged in. That's how I see it progressing. It's kind of like a domino theory in a way, but it's widening.
Does Israel get pulled in on something like this?
I didn't really look at Israel in this book.
How come?
Well, I thought that the U.S. would be involved in the Mideast. That's one part of my scenario.
Right.
And that kind of emboldens China to take more aggressive and expansionist steps in the Pacific, because we would be heavily invested elsewhere.
At this point, David, do you think China, the Chinese government, hates our guts? Do they just tolerate us? I mean, they're holding trillions of dollars of debt. We buy their goods and services. Why go to war with the United States?
Well, I certainly agree. I think it would be disadvantageous to them to go to war. But the question is, what national interest is worth they're going to war for? Now, what the scenario I've set up does not envision the current regime being in power.
Okay.
In other words, I almost called this almost to the month, the Chinese stock market has crashed in my scenario.
In your scenario. Well, that could happen.
Yeah, I kind of called that one, but my stock market crash is much worse. It's actually a major depression in China. And a continuing character in my books, General Zhang Zhurong, who has appeared before, is kind of a Putin-like figure, who transitions from the intelligence service in China to the first figure in the state. So now he's the leader of China. And in order to distract the people from their economic miseries, he embarks on an expansionist and imperialist, if you will, course, calling forth a nationalist instinct and playing the card that China is going to become what he calls the people's empire. It is going to exercise hegemony in the Pacific. So we're just moving things a little bit ahead in the future, if you will.
So as we look at China and the United States at this point, novel aside, what could truly be the tipping point to create this issue? You know, we see the encroachment issues over these islands that are out there. What do you think could really be the catalyst?
Well, you know, I think the catalyst is probably, you're looking at these the islands that you're talking about. I assume you're talking about the Paracels and the Spratlys.
Yeah.
Okay. The Paracels are pretty firmly in the Chinese camp at this point. The only other country that has a claim there is the Vietnamese, and frankly, we're not in a position to come to the support of the Vietnamese yet. The Spratly Islands, that's a very interesting territorial dispute because you've got 4 to 5 countries claiming all these little islets there. And the islets, the 4 or 5 islets that the Chinese claim are very small, just barely above sea level, and there's really no oil or gas deposits or anything else there that are in the public record that is worth fighting over. So I don't really see a national interest at stake. I don't see the Chinese going to war for this problem.
Not for that. Stay with us, David. Going to hit the break, but we'll come right back and talk more about Tipping Point on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Now, those of you interested in these world events will take phone calls with David Poyer next hour, but I'm going to continue chatting with him here about Tipping Point, the war with China, the first salvo. It's a novel, folks. I don't want you just turning on your radios going, oh, my God, are we at war with China? No, no, no. This is a novel, but it's got some real strong possibilities in it. Trigger points, things that could happen. David, I agree with you. I don't think the islands will be the justification for a war with China at all. It'll be something much bigger, some kind of an involvement. And it's unfortunate. Is there any possibility that before this happens, smarter heads will prevail and not do anything?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, smarter heads dragged us into World War One. Smarter heads tried to appease Hitler, and the result was unfortunate, to say the least. Smarter heads managed to run the Cold War for how many years? And it didn't go hot, but it cost a lot of lives, didn't it?
Sure did.
And I want to return a little bit to what you said about islands, if I might.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about the Spratlys, and we kind of agreed that the Spratlys were too far from China to support, that they were too scattered, and that they weren't really a Chinese national interest for them to fight for. But there is a group of islands to the north of that that might be a very dangerous flashpoint. Can I talk a bit about them?
Yeah. Are these the ones closer to Japan?
They're exactly. They're between Taiwan and Japan. They're the Senkaku Islands. They're about 100 miles northeast of Taiwan, and the interesting thing about them is they're unpopulated. They're larger than the Spratly Islands. They could be air bases. They could be amphibious bases, but the great thing about them for the Chinese is that they flank Taiwan. Anyone who occupies the Senkaku Islands can completely block off sea and air access to most of the industrial centers of Taiwan. To the capital, Taipei. So actually, you've kind of got, if you were on a chessboard and Taiwan were the king, you've actually got the king in check if you occupy the Senkaku Islands. So as China continues to build up its amphibious forces and its air forces, if they're able to quickly occupy the Senkakus and keep the Japanese from kicking them back out, they've effectively won Taiwan without a battle on Taiwan itself.
Well, that's a strong possibility there.
Well, the question then is, we would have to come to Japan's assistance. And we are, although we're not bound by treaty specifically to assist Taiwan, we are bound by treaty to assist Japan. So it would inevitably drag us in unless we said, hey, no, we're not going to fight for uninhabited islands.
Well, and treaties are meant to be broken sometimes, aren't they?
Well, you know, we're not supposed to do that, right?
Right, right. We've got one with Turkey, too. So where does Russia fit into this scenario, if they do at all?
Oh, yes. Russia's definitely going to be the winner. In any fight between China and the United States, the Chinese bloc and the Allied bloc, Russia is going to stand back and just coin money. They are going to send arms. They're going to send ammunition. They're going to make money hand over fist, selling things to both sides.
But they're not going to directly get involved against us siding with China, I don't think.
I really don't see how it would be to their advantage. In fact, it would be very much to their disadvantage if they sided against China, because China has an enormous land army. China has the demographic advantage over Russia, and Russia has a lot of empty, very inviting land in Siberia. Mm-hmm. I can see the Chinese saying, look at all that land. Look at all our people. There's something wrong with this picture.
We want it back.
So, exactly, and they have claims to it also.
Well, that's true. So in your scenario, does anybody pull out a nuke here?
Well, yes. I don't want to give away the ending of the book.
All right.
But yes, I guess the answer is affirmative.
All right. Well, let's not talk about the ending of the book, but let's talk about the possibilities of things happening for real. Oh, my God, if two power nations pull out nukes, David, they obliterate half the planet.
Well, the question is, what is war termination between two nuclear-armed powers? We've never had a war between two nuclear-armed powers. And the question is, how do you terminate such a war? And that is a very sticky question, George, because either side can escalate, and then either side can counter-escalate. Where does it end? And does it end with mutual obliteration? Exactly. That's why we and the USSR never went to war, really. We were both too scared.
I mean, do you really win if you're the last one standing with one city and all your other cities are in rubble and your citizens are dead?
I don't think so.
I don't think you win.
I don't think you win. No. Absolutely not. So, but the question is, how do you end the war then? If you can't have victory, and you can't really have defeat because China can't invade the United States if we have nuclear weapons, and we can't invade China if they have nuclear weapons, then what's the war termination possibility here? How do you end the war? That's really not a military question. That's a political question.
So do they weigh, in these war games that both sides are playing,
mm-hmm.
do they weigh, one, will this nation really pull out its nukes? Will they take the first strike? Will they make the first strike? Or will they just go conventionally? And even if they think they're going to lose the war in some geographical area, they're going to back down and not use a nuke. Do they think that way?
In every war game that I have participated in or heard about, it has been very, very difficult to get either side to go nuclear. The umpires had to really coach them, practically hold guns to their head and say, now you have to, you know, initiate the nuclear phase of the conflict. Nobody wanted to do it. Now, that's not to say that it couldn't happen by accident, that you couldn't have some rogue commander pull the trigger, that you couldn't have some natural event, like you were talking about comets earlier in the program.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say you had a meteor hit northern China, like the meteor that hit Siberia not too long ago. Let's say the Chinese take that for a U.S. nuclear strike. It could happen by accident.
I believe most Russians at the time, a few years ago, where 1,400 people were injured, thought that maybe somebody detonated a nuke over their atmosphere.
Well, I mean, that's a natural conclusion there.
Well, you know,
even satellites sometimes have difficulty telling what a certain event is. Is it a nuclear detonation or is it something else?
What about buzz buys and the possibility of somebody pushing too far? I'm amazed, by the way, at Vladimir Putin's restraint against Turkey shooting down their jet. I'm amazed that he didn't do anything. That shows me something.
Well, you know, just because he didn't do anything right away doesn't mean he doesn't have some
far-laid plan
to get his own back. He's not the kind of guy to let something like that slide, I don't think.
I was always told while I was in the Navy that the greatest deterrent to war was our nuclear subs, that we had them parked off the coasts of everybody, and that in a moment's notice we could launch and hit them within 10 minutes.
Well, absolutely, but Chinese also have such submarines, and that also acts as a deterrent force against us. And as time goes on, their deterrent is going to increase in density and capability. That's why I say nobody really knows what the war termination scenario is when two nuclear powers go to war, and that's what makes it so dangerous. And that is why the U.S. and the USSR were always so wary of each other, and why we sent in, cat's paws. We would recruit third parties to fight for us. We tried not to face each other directly.
David, what about weakness? China would look at us and say, okay, the Americans are in Afghanistan. not as much as we were, but we're still there. We're in Iraq. We're spread out all over the planet. They're too weak to have a conventional war against us. Therefore, we're going to do what we want to do. They're not going to stop us.
Well, so you're asking what our weaknesses are?
Well, I'm asking you what China would think about our weaknesses.
Well, we definitely have some Achilles heels. Certainly compared to them, we have a lack of manpower. And not just raw manpower, but the Army now is having difficulty fulfilling its quotas for the all-volunteer force. And that is just all-volunteer force. We would need a much expanded Army in the case of a major conflict. We have problems with obesity. We have problems with physical readiness. We have problems with industrial infrastructure. Oh, here's something that I learned that it was really going to make your skin crawl. 90% of the gunpowder that the Army and the armed forces use in their small arms comes from one plant in St. Marks, Florida. 90%, and it gets even worse. Not only do they make the gunpowder for the small arms in one plant, but also they make the propellants for the actuators in missiles and things like ejection seats.
Jeez.
And other actuators that we use in more advanced weapons. So you put that one plant out of commission, and we're basically crippled.
That plant will be taken out in an instant, wouldn't it?
Well, sabotage, one strike from a submarine offshore, and we're crippled.
We emasculated Japan after World War II. We literally took away their military. There's no way they could defend themselves against China.
Oh, the Japanese?
Yeah.
Now?
Yeah.
Oh, the Japanese have an excellent Navy. The Japanese they call it a self-defense force, but it is beautifully modern.
Do you think they could battle China?
I think they could do a very, very, there would be a lot of wreckage floating in the Korea Strait, a lot of wreckage, but I think they could, it would be fairly even, I think. And when things like that are fairly even, the other side tends not to try it.
Well, what was it, Sun Tzu, that said that don't go to war if you don't think you can win? I'm paraphrasing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No, the Japanese have an excellent Navy. It's small in numbers compared to the Chinese, but technologically it's fully interoperative with us. They have Aegis cruisers. They have beautifully new submarines, and they're wonderful seamen. I actually have operated, not with the Japanese, but with the South Korean Navy, and they also are wonderful seamen, modern ships, very impressive. I was really impressed operating with them.
David, if somebody were to look at events that could lead and trigger a war, what would they be? What are the things that we should realistically look for as signs?
The things that, you mean like... things that would lead up to war, or things that, I think I know what you mean, like signals?
Signals.
Okay, well, the first thing, almost every war, the first thing that happens, an aggressor starts to build up stockpiles. So I think you were talking about debt a little earlier in the
mm-hmm,
program.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing we would want to see is if they start liquidating their debt and buying things that they would need if they were blockaded, primarily food. If they start liquidating their debt in the U.S. and buying food, buying strategic materials, that's an early warning sign.
Okay.
The next thing is crippling our communications. The next thing is cyber attacks, taking down our banking systems, taking down our financial systems, taking down our communications. One of the things that happens in Tipping Point is they take down the three servers that control every credit card
processing,
processor that operates every gas station in the United States. So suddenly nobody can get gas in the whole continental United States.
Well, that's pretty smart.
Once you can't get gas, you're pretty much stuck at home.
Right.
So that's a weak point. But yeah, those are the kinds of things that we would look for at the beginning. Now, the next step after that is they're going to sortie their submarines. They're going to shoot down our satellites because our satellites give us not only communication, they also give us area surveillance.
And in terms of time, how close would these events be structured to each other?
Well, that kind of I would say weeks.
Okay, so it's not going to be like, oh my gosh, you know, our gasoline pumps aren't working. We get them fixed, and then a month later something else happens. These would be pretty chronological and pretty quick, I would think.
I think it would be pretty quick because remember what I was saying about the United States having to debate whether to go to Taiwan's assistance. That is going to be a signal from them, don't do it. Hands off, Taiwan. This is our business.
Meanwhile, are we doing the same thing when this is happening to us?
Well, the Army has 27 different teams that are planning cyber attacks. We don't know against whom. We don't know what the cyber attacks will be, but I have confidence that the Army has something planned.
They might even be planned against us, the citizenry.
Can't speculate.
Okay, so we've got this, what I would call, softening up of command. Then, when things start to get a little hotter, what happens?
Well, when things get hotter, you've got a breakdown of communications, you've got a breakdown of targeting, you've got a sortieing of their submarines, and then what we have to do is close the choke points. The choke points, of course, you're familiar with.
Explain that to people who haven't been in the Navy.
Well, the choke points are the areas of egress, the areas of exit, the way that they escape from the narrow seas close to China out into the Pacific. They have to get out into the Pacific in order to interdict our communications.
Right. These are strategic points that military cuts off so its opponent can't get through.
Yes. Now, the reason that they want their submarines out in the Pacific, of course, is because we have logistical lines. If we're going to fight in the Western Pacific, we have to ship everything from the West Coast. And most of it is going to go by ship. Now, if it goes by ship, it can be sunk. And if it can be sunk by a Chinese submarine, they're going to win the war.
Okay. What about shooting down satellites?
Well, that actually happens in the latter part of Tipping Point. When the war begins, the Chinese are shooting down our satellites, and one of Dan's assignments is to shoot down a Chinese satellite with the missiles aboard USS Savo Island.
Wow.
And one of the things that we learn is that it's not an easy thing to shoot down a satellite. It's not simple. It involves a lot of calculation. It's like hitting a bullet with a bullet at a combined closing rate of about 30,000 miles an hour.
It might be easier, though, satellite to satellite.
It might be, but we don't really. I think that's prohibited by treaty, I believe.
You think we're honoring that? What do you think, David?
Me? Oh, I'm not paid to think about that.
I would think we probably have a system like that.
We have a system to shoot down satellites. In fact, we have several. And one of them is Navy-based aboard Ticonderoga-class cruisers.
So are they laser?
I'm sorry?
Are they laser or missile?
They're missile. Now, we don't have a laser yet with that capability. The laser power that we have so far is basically up to shooting down a slow drone. And it's a question of not just power, but also dwell time, atmospheric disturbance, gyro stabilization. You have to get the spot on the target, and you have to keep it exactly on the right part of the target for a measurable period of time so that it burns through the skin of the target.
Is it too naive, David, to think about a perfect world where there will be no wars, that we don't have any of this to worry about?
Well, I don't think it's ever naive to dream, but I think it's naive to expect it to happen in our lifetimes.
I think so, too. I just don't understand why nations must continue to war. I just don't get it. Instead of trying to help each other exist and, you know, build a great planet.
Well, you know, you can look at it as each of us is born into a world in which we own nothing, and we have to struggle for everything we get.
I would think Tipping Point may be the beginning of a series of novels like this.
I think if I am spared, I will do 5 novels about this war.
I love it. David, stay with us. We're going to hit a break. We're going to come back, continue talking about Tipping Point, and also we'll take some phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. David's website, of course, is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back.